Good evening. Well, when we first began studying the Vimalakirti Sutra, it had been a long time since I had looked at it, much less studied it. So I read it through, and then I just let myself be surprised week after week. And just before Tuesday night, usually Monday, I would read it with care and compare it to Thomas Cleary and sometimes to other translators and went more deeply into it. So yesterday I opened it up and thought, oh, we've got two more chapters. That's nice. And then I opened Cleary and there was just one chapter. And I checked it out here, and of course that it isn't really a chapter, the last thing. It's called an entrustment. So it's a kind of last gesture. It's just two pages long of consolidating all the teaching that went on before. So I thought tonight we will probably finish this, which was a big surprise. But hey, that's good. There are a lot of wonderful other things we can do. And I would like to encourage you all to think of some things that you would like to study. I know we've done that before, and we probably have a list somewhere of possibilities. There are many, many wonderful translations and commentaries and ancient things and very modern ones as well. So think about it. So in this translation this chapter is called the offering of the law. The law meaning dharma, meaning truth, basic truth. Cleary calls it past practice and bequest of truth. Bequest is what you give people who come after you. Here I've given you this, and now it's up to you. And it's a very interesting conversation because it starts out with the chief of the gods addressing Buddha and addressing the assembly, this great assembly that has gathered in this tiny room. And there's the Indra, the chief of the gods, addressing the Buddha, saying, world-honored one, though I have heard hundreds and thousands of sutras from the Buddha and Manjushri, I've never heard one with such astounding freedom of action, transcendental powers, and unfailing grasp of the true reality. He said, according to my understanding of what the Buddha has just said, if living beings hear this sutra on the law and believe and understand it and accept and unhold it, etc., they will surely without doubt acquire it. And how much so, more so if they practice it as the law directs. They will shut off all evil paths of existence and open the gates to all good ones. So, he said they will cultivate and practice enlightenment and rest secure in the place of practice, following in the way trod by the thus come one, by Buddha. And he says, if there are people who do this, that I and my followers will offer alms to them and serve them. So that's a whole nother hierarchy that exists up there somewhere, presumably. The God realm is part of the eternal round, So anyone who is lucky enough to be born in the God realm is inevitably going to be reborn in another one of the categories, either the animal realm or the hell realm, or if he's lucky, the human realm. These are all, in my view, psychological ways of explaining how the human mind shifts from one kind of way to be to others. And I can't say that it goes lifetime to lifetime, but it certainly goes in, within a life, from one aspect to another, so that there are times when we are very upset and angry, and that's the warrior realm, you could say, and it's helpful to recognize it. In any case, they're all going to jump on the wagon. They're all part of it too. And the Buddha's very happy about that and says, I'll help you. He said, Heavenly Lord, if good men and good women accept, uphold, read, recite, and make offerings, they are making offerings to the Buddhas of past, future, and present. So, the Buddha said, you should understand if there are good women and good men who are doing, hearing this sutra on emancipation, that Bodhi, the enlightenment of the Buddhas, is born, all born from this teaching, the Dharma. The marks of enlightenment are beyond limit or measure, and for that reason their blessings are immeasurable. So we've heard the teaching all the way through here, and the teaching is the same simple things that we've already been practicing for a long time. The precepts, the paramitas, the Eightfold Path, all of which are just words to describe how we try to navigate our way with kindness and patience in a very confusing sometimes and certainly very complicated life and world. Just helps for us that once we begin to look for what is the truth in each situation, what is the true teaching here, we don't have to say, oh, the precepts say blah blah blah, but we can reconnect with our own life and practice as we face whatever it is that we're having to face. And we do have to face many different things, and we often don't know what the answer is. So Buddha is begins to entertain various people, one called the Jeweled Parasol, who came to make offerings. There's the Medicine King, and the Medicine King's sons, Moon Parasol, who is asking if there isn't some offering that's better than the offerings that have already been made. And through the Buddha's supernatural power, a heavenly being appeared in the sky and said, good man, the offerings of the law is the finest of all offerings. And the son asked, well, what is the offering of the law? And the heavenly being replied, go and ask the Thus Come One Medicine King. He'll explain to you in detail the offering of the law. So we're still in a fairy tale. We still have all kinds of people showing up. At once the Prince Moon Parasol went to call on the Thus Come One Medicine King. He bowed his head in obeisance and retired to one side and asked the Buddha, "Among all offerings, the offering of the law is the finest, but what is the offering of the law?" And the Buddha said, "Good man, the offering of the law means the profound sutras preached by the Buddha, the teachings. The people of this world all find them hard to believe and hard to accept, for they are wonderfully subtle and hard to make out. They cannot be grasped through the making of distinctions or through thought. They are contained in the storehouse of the Bodhisattva and are sealed with the Dharani seal, the seal of memory that ensures full retention of the teaching." It says, "They bring about observance of the six paramitas, the skillful discrimination of meanings, and compliance with the teachings of enlightenment. And through the finest of all sutras, one enters the realm of great pity and compassion." So he goes on, they enable living beings to sit in the place of practice and to turn the wheel of the law. So then, heavenly beings and dragons and Gandharvas and others join in praising them. And relying on the principle of the true nature of all phenomena, they clearly set forth the doctrines of impermanence, suffering, emptiness, no ego, and tranquil extinction. They can save all living beings who violate the prohibitions, and they can inspire fear in some kind of people, and they turn away from the sufferings of birth and death, etc. So hearing these teachings and upholding them, one is thereby guarding and protecting the law, and this is called the offering of the law. This sounds very abstract to me, but I think it's pointing to the importance as we live our life to keep checking. Is this true? Is this true? How am I taking this? Am I able to take this in a way that feels true? And how can I check it? I don't think it means to go back to some kind of holy book. It does. I don't think they're pointing to going back to, except on an ordinary kind of level. Of course, the sutras are very interesting and wonderful to read. But it's about checking our own mind and our own life. Is this wise? Is this good? Does this have pity and compassion in it? It's tricky. So he goes on to say that the sutras teach one to rely on meaning, not on words, to rely on wisdom, not on consciousness, to rely on sutras or teachings that are complete in meaning, not on those that are incomplete, and to rely on the teaching, not on the person, to go along with the true form of things, realizing there is no entering in and no destination. There's no entering in and no destination. They teach that since ignorance in the end does not exist, so too action in the end does not exist. And so on through the 12-link chain of causation down to the fact that since birth in the end doesn't exist, so too old age and death in the end do not exist. When one learns to see in this manner, those links in the chain will cease to have any form that comes to an end, and one will no longer entertain the view that it does. This is called the finest offering of the law. In other words, all of our ideas about how things are, especially around the subject of life and death, our being, if we cobble together a huge little package of ideas that explain everything, we're very, very far from the actual experience of truth. That our practice is about how we live and enact our life, not how we figure it out. If life has a meaning, it has a meaning in our actions. And if we try to explain too much, we just muddy it all up. The most profound things really can't be explained, but we can see it happen before our very eyes. We can do it ourselves. And we can share it just by the kind of gestures of our life without having to explain to ourselves or to anybody else. That if we're grounded in the truth, then we aren't I don't know how to say how we aren't, because we're still confused. It isn't that we lose our confusion or our bewilderment ever. We never do really quite know moment to moment. But allowing ourselves to return over and over to our own wisdom and whatever resonates, rings in us about what we hear from others and what we study, is the very best. That's what we are, and that's what we do. That's what we're hungry for. It's kind of nourishment, the truth. It feeds us. Sometimes it tastes really weird, like a strange medicine, because we don't, if it makes us, makes me look not very good, the way I'd like to look, it's hard to take. Oh, no, that's not true. But then looking at it some more, I think, oh, it's true, thank you. Better do something about that. So it's not dramatic. I'm not singing violins or golden lights or any of that. It's just a very, very simple returning again and again to our own wisdom and finding it in others and celebrating it. So then it was the last bit is called the entrustment, and Maitreya is suddenly there, the bodhisattva of the future, who has not been around until now. And Maitreya is accepting the law and very glad to do it. And so then he is told by Buddha, you should understand there are two kinds of bodhisattvas. So be sure to know what kind of bodhisattva you're going to be. He said the first type loves how to talk about it, phrases and literary embellishments. And the second isn't afraid of the depth, the deeper principles, and can enter into the true meaning. So be sure to attend to who you listen to. Don't get carried away with all the fancy words, because that's not it. And there are two attitudes among beginners that keeps them from getting a grasp on these profound teachings. And some of them are alarmed and timorous, and some of them don't want to get too close to it. These are all descriptions of the things that we pass through as we try to face the truth of things. And in Zazen, we do this. In Zazen, things come up that we can sometimes be very alarmed or timorous or just plain refuse. Nope, I'm not going to look at that. I'm not going to go there. I think we can trust that not going just as well as you can trust your going. Being brave and facing things, I think there's a time and a place for each thing. We don't force ourselves into some sort of bravado of being really, really true. Just be patient and kind with oneself. But always keep referring back, is this true for me? Does this feel right? So Buddha's really glad about Maitreya. He says, it's just what you said. It's just like that. And he tells Ananda, please accept and uphold this sutra and propagate it far and wide, because Ananda is the one who memorized everything that Buddha said. So he said, you remember this one too, the Vimalakirti Sutra. You tell everybody about it. And he says, I will. What shall I call it? And Buddha said the sutra should be called Expositions of Vimalakirti, or Paradoxical Presentation by Pairs, or the Book of Inconceivable Liberation. And when the Buddha had finished expounding this sutra, the rich man, Vimalakirti, Manjushri, Shariputra, Ananda, and the others, along with the heavenly and human beings, Asuras, and all the other members of the great assembly, were filled with joy at hearing the preaching of the Buddha. And they believed and accepted it and respectfully put it into practice. A very low-key ending, a very kind and respectful and low-key ending, i.e. just stick to what's true. Do your best. And if we don't see giant bodhisattvas and huge chairs or gandharvas and asuras come flying in from another land, we do see marvels. We see marvels every day. So it's as all this material is, it's just about being awake. Really attending to what we are and we see. I saw one of my many doctors this afternoon, and he said, you're fine. That was nice. And then he said, so what is the difference between Hinduism and Buddhism? He said, there's just one difference. And I thought, oh, you're testing me. Okay. So I said, Atman and Anatman. Either there's a great self That's the great Atman, the great God, or there is none, or the great self, you could say, the overarching God-ishness of everything, or there is none. An means not, or no. So it also means self and no self. So it's about whether we're encouraged to project something up there, or whether we step back and begin to address where our actual experience is coming from. So that was, Buddha was a Hindu, and almost as the doctor said, and I know it's true, that almost everything in Hinduism is what Buddha said too. But there was this crucial thing of getting people out of the selfness of themselves, of the obsession that we develop around being a self, rather than letting it be a loose and flowing thing. It was very interesting. He grew up in an ashram in India, so he's very devoted to practice. Was suggesting I should go to an ashram and was naming the ones that might be good. He said, they're wonderful. He said, they'll take good care of you. Really nice. sounds wonderful. So, are there questions? Discussion? Suggestions?
At one point, it said rely on wisdom, not consciousness.
Yes.
I was wondering why consciousness was chosen to contrast wisdom.
I think that's, consciousness is really how we know ourself as a self. It's how we identify things, how we name things. I think in those terms. And as we're doing that, we are ignoring the wordless side. You could say the side of silence, or the side that we experience in Zazen that does not have our own engineering and direction involved in it. That there's an energetic in the world and in us and our life that is not our consciousness. It's us. And as we sit, we feel it. And we live by it. Or it lives, I can't even say, it's just how the whole thing works together. And of course, consciousness is very important, and it's how we have airplanes flying in the air. But if we depend only on consciousness, we're missing 50% of how to live. And it's when we begin to connect with our wounds and begin to feel soft and vulnerable that we begin to touch that other side. And touching that other side, we begin to open up to things as they are. We're available to what's in our experience rather than closed off with thinking. So it's thinking and not thinking and non-thinking. All of those things go together in practice. Paul.
Reminds me of a koan. not knowing is most intimate.
Yes.
Trusting.
Yes.
That not knowing.
Yes.
That empty space.
It's a scary place sometimes.
Yes.
Yeah.
You notice.
Yes, I do. Yeah. And it's the point. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Jeffrey. Well,
I'd like to piggyback on what Paul said. I've been reading a wonderful book of poetry called, written by Dick Allen. It's called The Zen Master Poems. One of his poems, which is called Don't Know, has the opening three lines are, when, quote, don't know, unquote, embraces the universe, where are you? I just love that. It just,
yes.
I read that and I went, whoa.
There it is. Don't need a you anymore.
A lovely book.
That sounds great.
Now, Dick Allen, who was a poet laureate of Connecticut from 2010 to 2015.
I'll be darned.
Was also and has been a Buddhist practitioner.
Uh-huh.
He's 77.
Great. Great.
Good book.
Well, it's 8 o'clock. Strange as it may seem. There are announcements?
Yeah, announcements. If anybody is interested in some poetry, we're having a poetry festival down at Fishby Park this Sunday. It's been well advertised, although I haven't mentioned it here at Person. Poet laureate from San Francisco is coming down. I think four former Santa Clara poet laureates are presenting, and that it goes all day long.
Mm.
So you're certainly welcome. And,
History Park.
History Park.
Yeah.
15 dollars.
I'm sorry. What?
$15.
You've read correctly. It's not free.
Try to get down there.
I have the honor of presenting with the Veterans Right Group.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Oh, good. So, that'll be good for them.
And I also have the honor of reading a couple of my fellow poets who can't make it, but who wrote some pretty fabulous poems. So.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Excellent, Jeffrey. Okay.
Well, I could remind people that we're having a business meeting following a regular schedule. Not next Tuesday, but following Tuesday, I believe this is the 27th. And we don't have a whole lot of business meetings. But, so this is your opportunity to find out how we function and have a voice in it, too.
And we're finally about to get our nonprofit status that has been dangling in the air for months and months. But I saw John on Saturday, and he said it's almost done. So that will be very helpful and useful. Yeah. One minute, sit.